This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, so we have Emilio DeSoto with us here today. He's the co-founder and CEO of DeSoto Sport. Really excited to have Emilio here for a number of reasons. One, it's going to be very apparent to you that he has done a fantastic job of merging his passion with his pocketbook. And I wish that on all of you guys. If you can find something that you are super, super passionate about and figure out how you can make money pursuing that passion, you will be a happy person. I can guarantee you. Is that Jimi Hendrix? His ghost? Anyway, so I think you're going to enjoy that aspect of Emilio's story. I know I have already. Let me give you a little bit of quick background. He's involved in every aspect of the business. It's another fun part about being a founder and a CEO is you can get involved in things you really want to, and you can hire people to do things that maybe you're less excited about. He earned his mechanical engineering degree here at UCSB, and he then went on and earned an MBA in marketing from San Diego State. So that's a good combination. So I talked about his passion. He raced in a record-breaking 30 consecutive seasons as a triathlon athlete. And he did that at the highest levels. I mean, he did that at a world championship level. So this isn't something like recreational triathlon athlete. This is an elite athlete. He stopped competing after his wife had their first son. And again, I told you guys, I try to bring people in here that are sane and have balance. They have balance to their lives. They go out there and they work really, really hard in their professional life, but they also work really hard on their personal life. And Emilio is absolutely no exception to that. He's worked very diligently on building an environmentally friendly home down in San Diego, and it's close enough for him to walk his boys to school as soon as they get a little bit older. He spends his weekend not driving cars, but riding his bike and walking to the farmer's market. And he tries to live an organic and farm-to-table lifestyle. He has a million passions besides biking and running and swimming. And I get kind of fatigued just reading them to you. He does a lot of stand-up paddling. Of course, that's not good enough. He has to do, like, competitions and long distance. And so he's doing all kinds of stuff on the ocean. He's doing ocean swimming, snowboarding. And he spends a fair amount of his time in Canada in the winter. And I would assume he's doing that to snowboard. Let's welcome to our class.
How's it going? How you guys doing tonight? Good. Way before there were ever computers that are on your lap and small phones that you can do things while a lecture is going on, I started giving lectures. And in order to keep people from getting bored, I figured that I would offer them an alternative. And that alternative was to try to figure something out that I wrote on the board. This one here might keep you busy for a while, but it is absolutely possible. Wait, let me make sure this is right. It is absolutely possible with the proper punctuation to make this entire sentence make sense. Okay? So if you get bored, if your MacBook Pro battery goes dead and your cell phone battery goes dead, and you don't have any sort of power source underneath your chair, feel free to take a gander, okay? I'll solve the problem at the end of the class. I actually made this one up myself a long time ago, and it's kind of fun, I mean, considering that it's not electronic. So for the next 4 hours, I'm going to try to...
Five.
I'm going to try to show you what it is that an ordinary guy like me has done since I graduated from UC Santa Barbara that has brought me to a point where I've been able to do all the things that John says that I do, and maybe even show you some pictures of them and stuff like that. They were in this kind of order where I would be able to just click and say something and click and say something, and now I'm going to have to kind of pan down because we weren't able to take care of the technical parts. But anyway, I was a triathlete for many years. Let me scroll down here. I do like to SUP surf a lot. I like to surf big waves. I like to snowboard. I spend 3 weeks a year snowboarding in Canada. My lift is a helicopter instead of a ski lift. My runs are places people have never been down before. This is me and three buddies and a couple of mountain guys. Well, there's one mountain guide who shot the photo, and the guy in the very front is also a very experienced mountain guide. So if there's any crevasses or cliff bands or things like that, they'll hit it and not us. But we pay the money to be able to have that happen. Let me keep going down here. I had this girlfriend. Her name was Tracy. Had a bunch of... See if this were all in order, it'd be so great. But that's okay. I mean, you guys can kind of see what's going on here. So we'll just make it happen. Tracy and I fell in love. We did a bunch of cool things like drive across the Pyrenees from Barcelona to Bilbao to the Guggenheim Museum on a BMW RT1200, about 1,200 kilometers. She'd never been on a bike before. All of our luggage was in these panniers on the side, and it was a little top heavy, and every time I would lean one way, she would lean another. It was really tough for me. But she was a champ. She lasted 1,200 miles on a motorcycle, so that's the type of girl that you might want to consider marrying or at least having some wine on your roof deck. We went to lots of live shows, 17 fish shows in all, before I decided to take her to watch the man burn on the playa in the Black Rock Desert. And hey, this is working out pretty well here. It's not taking a whole lot more time. To just have to pan a little bit faster. What's this? Oh, so then we got married. But we didn't just get married. We didn't have a wedding. We eloped to Cozumel, and we had a wedding ceremony that was just us two in the sand with no shoes. And then after that, we decided to start a family. So there she is with our first little boy. That's little Emilio. I'm Emilio De Soto II. So this is Emilio De Soto III. He's got a gangsta sign. It's E3. let's see. let me just keep panning here. Let's see. I showed you that one. That's the wine one. Okay, fish. So we love the little guy. This is him now at 3 years old. We've actually got two. That's little Emilio and baby Massimo. And when you guys become parents, you guys will probably do the same thing if you have to give a lecture. And some people are going, oh, how cute. And other you guys are going, get on with it. And that's all cool because besides them, we've got some cats. that's Havana at the top. That's Spanky at the bottom. I rescued them from near death. They've been with me since January 14th of 2000. I love them dearly. And let's see, that's Tracy with a stroller running along the beach by our house. This is Winnensea Beach, the beach where we live at. It's a couple more little photos of the kids. This is us in Chamonix. And so here we go. If you want to see what I looked like when I went to school at UC Santa Barbara, that was me as a freshman. That's on the little patio area of San Nicolas Dorm. All those eucalyptus trees are gone now. They used to be there. You didn't have a view out San Nicolas Dorm unless you were on the sixth floor or above. Not only did I rescue cats, I rescued a crow. His name was Joe, Spanish translation, Jose Cuervo. I still remain a fan of tequila, but it must be made of 100% agave. Let's see. That's me, Tracy, and the boys in Paris. And that's Tracy. Are you guys familiar with Mondrian? Do you guys know Mondrian? Anybody? That's okay, because if you did, you'd probably be in an art class and not in a technology management lecture. But Piet Mondrian was an amazing artist, but he was also a really great architect. And this is actually the hotel elevator at the hotel in Las Vegas. Totally, totally coincidental, but we were there for a trade show. One of the benefits of being married to an apparel designer is I make my wife dresses. And I made this one. She stepped in the elevator. I just went, baby, we got to shoot this. This is just too cool. So anyway, the Mondrian artwork that is shown here is called Floating Squares. And if you've never seen it before, you will see it a lot. And from now on, you will think of me. And that's not really a good thing. So let's move out of this one. Hey, I did it right on. Just going to show you real quick what my house looks like since everything's disorganized. Let's see if we can make this happen here. All right, so this is the beach in front of my house. Winnensea Beach, San Diego. Amazing place. How do I make it go to the next one? See, I would be nervous right now if this was my fault, but I'm not because it's not. So let's see if this will work. Oh, that'll work. Okay. So what we did was build a small house. It's 18 feet wide at its widest point. This is a lot on the beach, 25 feet wide. So it's basically my dream double wide, triple high trailer home. All right. We're fans of Dwell magazine and all the minimalist and stuff like that that goes with it. But we're also fans of the idea of building a home that when it goes to get torn down in 50 years or 30 years, maybe even 20, if we sell it and someone really dislikes it, 90% of what you see, of what this house is composed of, will be either recyclable, reusable, or repurposed. A good part of it is recycled. The windows are aluminum, or the casements are aluminum, the glass is recycled. We've used all sorts of cool stuff like bamboo floors and bamboo sinks, and we have a green kitchen, but no, really, literally, figuratively, we have a green kitchen, okay? Green cabinets and stuff like that. Let me just see if we can pan through here. What else? So it's not a big house. It's 2,000 square feet. Might not mean anything to you if you don't really know the size of the place you live in right now, but it's not particularly big. We designed it to live in it. This isn't the view from our house. This is a view from a place that we hope to own in Mexico one day. This is my little boy's bathroom. We wanted color. I'm not only a technical sort of person, but there was a certain amount of artistry in me that allowed me to be able to do things like pick colors for bathrooms. This is Tracy in our kitchen. We built the door on the south-facing side of the house. It completely slides open, and let's see, I think that it might have shown. Here it is up here. So we have a disappearing wall on the south side of the building. So our electricity bill is about $60 a month, which for a whole house, a family of four, it's pretty good. I mean, we're still working to get it lower. In this house, see the floors? Pretty cool, huh? I mean, it's loud, but they're super hard. They're kid-proof. It's easy. It's hard for them to scratch it. It's easy for them to bump their head really hard. We've also done our part in designing furniture that is pretty simple and plain table, bench, kind of like a picnic. It seats 14 people for family gatherings. This will also be the place where our boys will do a lot of their homework until they come to UC Santa Barbara. What's this doing up here? So it's probably not out of order. So this is where you walk down the street to get to the beach where our house exists. There's that bamboo sink. Our bathtub in the bedroom, because I've always liked going to hotels that had bathrooms or bathtubs in the bedroom. So we designed that that way. Plus, from the bathtub, I can watch SportsCenter. From the shower, I can watch SportsCenter. From the bed, I can watch SportsCenter. Or from the deck outside, I can watch SportsCenter. This is our cheesy retro 70s James Bond fireplace. It emits 12,000 BTUs, heats the place up really, really well. Natural gas, as you can see right now, it's not plugged in over there because this is when it was just finished. Right now, there's a lot of kid toys around it. We had fun with this, and again, this will all get some place during the talk. Again, I'm just trying to burn 5 hours. This is little Emilio and baby Massimo's bathroom. They're wall-hung toilets and wall-hung cabinets that are really low right now so that they can wash their hands and go to the bathroom. As they get bigger, we can actually raise them. Wasn't super expensive. to do, but we kind of thought it'd be a fun story and everything else. So that's it for the house. So, and that's, maybe we'll leave the beach one up for a little while here. So, I wrote 11 pages of transcripts so that I can make sure that I stick to that 4-hour schedule. Actually, no. I wrote this stuff, and I'll probably start to refer to this during the talk to keep me within what I hope to be well less than an hour, okay? My goal isn't to just fill up an hour. My goal is to enlighten you, entertain you, share with you my experiences and stuff like that. And so every now and then I might just take this thing and start to read it, okay? And so for that reason, I should probably have my glasses. I got away without reading glasses until I had my first child, and I think sleep deprivation really affected me. As I've explained already, Tracy's my wife. My two boys are Amelia and Massimo. I get up early, even before the boys were born. I always have. For some reason, throughout my entire life, I just couldn't wait to wake up in the morning. And I'm not really sure if this is a sort of characteristic that you should look at and go, oh, man, not me, man. I love sleeping, and so I'm not going to be able to do whatever it is that you do. Not at all. You probably just stay up a lot later than I do, okay? Let me digress a little bit and step back in time and tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in Cuba. I came here with my parents when I was 3. It was actually when I wasn't quite 3. It was shortly after the revolution, which happened in June of 1962. Castro was in power in Cuba. He promised the country that he would feed the poor, educate everybody, create a better life, change the dictatorship that Batista had. And the people who lived in Cuba, who had studied history, had seen these same promises from a lot of very charismatic people many years before. Lenin, Stalin, Hitler. Fortunately, my parents were educated enough to understand that in order to do that, there needed to be money coming from somewhere to do all that. And Castro didn't have money, okay? He had a lot of connections and a lot of charisma to be able to convince people of these changes that he was going to have or create. So during the time after the revolution and before the Missile Crisis, which was in October of 1962, Castro had a lottery system that permitted Cuban citizens to leave the country. So it wasn't quite the fleeing because we're getting shot at or, you know, genocide or war or anything like that. It was a very calculated opportunity for him to get rid of the people who might be smart enough to create some sort of counter-revolution to his revolution. At the time, in order to leave Cuba, you needed to do 3 things. Number one, you needed to turn all your possessions over to the government. Real estate, boats, businesses, whatever you had, okay? Number two, you had to quit your job. And number three, you had to understand that you were never coming back. By turning over your possessions, it also meant anything that you had of value, okay? Not just guns, but not that guns have value, but you got to understand it was just a revolution, okay? But not just things like that, but any of your assets, if you had gold, if you had jewelry, if you had anything of value, okay? And there were these little cells and pockets in major cities all over, and you never knew if your second cousin or your distant uncle might be part of Castro's regime and they might be spying on you. You never knew who was going to turn you in. So most people just kept quiet. And my parents quit their jobs, gave a lot of things to our very close relatives, because what they didn't want was to have to worry about the future of their two kids, myself and my sister, who's a couple years older than me. So time went by. They weren't working. Our lottery numbers came up. It was time to leave Cuba. We had heard to pack a fake suitcase. Don't put anything like valuables, clothes, pictures, anything in those fake suitcases. And so we did. And the reason why is because you would show up at the airport, buy your plane tickets, put your suitcase. It wasn't a conveyor belt back then. It was just a cart. You'd get on the plane, and whatever was in that suitcase, you would never see again because that suitcase never got on the plane. So you can see, early on during this exodus, a lot of people lost a lot of things that they thought that they were going to bring with them to the United States. So we arrived in Havana with not a cent. And I mean it. My sister, at 4 years old, had 6 pennies in her purse. And before she got on the plane, the pennies were taken away, and so was the purse. So all we had was the clothes on our back. We arrived in Miami. There were There were a number of programs in place to be able to assist the new immigrants and things like that. They put us up in relatively good conditions. You know, when you look and you see what it is that is going on in Syria and the way, you know, the refugees who are living in Jordan are living in tents and stuff like that. We lived in a condemned hotel, okay? Cockroaches, things like that. But at least we had a roof over our heads and Miami was a warm place. There was a church in Richmond, California, up in the Bay Area, a Mexican church that actually had a program to help Cuban exiles move to the West Coast and start a life here, because there were thousands upon thousands of Cubans that were settling in Miami, and if they went anywhere, they would just go north, okay, up into Jersey and to the Carolinas, into New York and everything. And my parents saw that this was a great opportunity for us. So this church basically lifted us up from Miami, flew us to Richmond, California, put a first and last month rent on a one-bedroom house, got us pots and pans, a radio, the things that we needed to get our lives going. And that was the last and the only handout that we ever asked for or accepted from anybody. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this is so that you see that there's been this certain drive in my family to show us what's important, because through the years, my parents started their careers over. The first jobs that my dad had when my sister and I were, you know, little kids living in Richmond, California, he was a civil engineer in Cuba. He worked as a dishwasher by day at Montgomery Ward's, and at the very same store worked as a janitor, okay? Think about labor laws now. There's no way you'd be able to work that many hours. They just wouldn't allow you. But see, he did, because he was able to and he needed to make some money for us to live. Up until the church closed, which wasn't long ago, we paid that church back every month. My parents, myself, just about everybody, or my sister and her family, sent money every month to that church, hoping that the few people who are even alive now, my parents are in their early 80s, who even are alive that might remember that we were there, saw our gratitude. But even if they didn't, somebody did, okay? Maybe a higher power, if you believe in that. We certainly do, but this isn't a religious class, so I'm not going to go there either, okay? once we got settled in Richmond, my mom got a job at a school called the Defense Language Institute in Monterey. Anybody from up in that area? It's usually very slim if anyone's from Monterey. Yeah? Great. So there's a language school up there that teaches every language in the world to government employees, military, CIA, FBI, Secret Service, to prepare these people to go to the bases back in the 60s and 70s, to all the bases that the United States had in different parts of the country. So I don't know if that's going to slideshow or not, but I'll just come over every now and then and just flip this thing. My mom hardly spoke any English when she started. Within 7 years, she understood the importance of being able to speak English and to speak it well. Within 7 years, I didn't get her brains, by the way, but within 7 years, she had gone to a school in Monterey also called the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and she had gotten a PhD in linguistics in English. So in 7 years, she went from not speaking any English at all to be an authority on the English language. She spoke with a very heavy accent. She still does, but she speaks perfect grammatical English. This allowed her over the years to not only move through to become a professor there, but she also became the director, or in a sense, the principal of the Spanish department at the DLI. Just the other day, my parents came over. They live in San Diego as well, and I'd just gotten back from a little run with the boys in the stroller, and I said, "Oh, yeah, hey, come on in," or anything. "Sorry, just went for a run." And my dad goes, "Oh, yeah? How far you went?" And my mom said, "No, papito. It's not how far you went. It's how far did you go?" this is, you know, my dad's always been kind of the butt of jokes of languages for many years, and my mom always corrected him. Monterey was a great place to grow up. I was an ordinary kid, smaller than most. I still am. It did have its disadvantages. I was always the last to get picked for teams, and it was not out of a lack of talent. It was just out of a lack of size. I quickly learned that team sports wasn't the thing for me. All right, individual sports is where I kind of gravitated, and the sports were fine. The size was something that affected me because I got picked on by a lot of kids. So between the ages of 13 and 15, I took a nonviolent form of self-defense called Aikido, and Aikido is really, just like all the forms of self-defense, really an amazing thing because you're basically taking the energy of someone who's coming at you and gently laying them down instead of hurting them. Now, yes, we learned ways to hurt people, but only to the point of scaring them and making them decide not to hurt you anymore. And Aikido, like a lot of other types of self-defense, doesn't depend on your size. You don't fight weight classes. In fact, you don't fight at all. There's no competitions per se like jiu-jitsu and judo and karate for Aikido. But what it teaches you to do is to take someone who's much bigger than you, and if they're bigger than you, that means you're able to transfer all that energy right back to them and make their fall that much harder. It was great for me because it taught me discipline, respect, and restraint. With the fact that I was such a small kid and the sports were a little harder, the team sports, I took up surfing. Did a lot of bike riding and things like that. I wrestled. I did gymnastics. Tried to find something that I could use as an outlet, but. And it might seem kind of strange that I'm mentioning this to you in this era, because I know that it has a little bit of a different stigma right now. But I joined Boy Scouts, And in Boy Scouts, I learned all sorts of things about myself, and it taught me a lot of confidence in how to be able to enjoy nature, appreciate nature, live off the land. I did my first 48-hour solo at the age of 14. You can't even do that now. If two parents let a 14-year-old kid go off into the Los Padres National Forest by themselves, they'd get picked up by Child Protective Services, you know. But it was something that, obviously, as a parent, it was difficult for my parents to allow me to do. But I think that I conveyed to them the confidence and the respect of nature to be able to convince them, just as with surfing up in the Northern California and Central California coast, that it was something that I'd be able to do and do well and handle. And thus my appreciation still for nature and camping and everything. I left Monterey to come to UC Santa Barbara. I was practically a straight-A student at Monterey High School. Like many of you, high school was pretty easy for me. I'm not sure if you share these sentiments, but when I got here and started studying mechanical engineering, I prayed every night to God to let me pass my engineering classes. It wasn't often that I got much better than a B. And most of my classes were just trying to pass. And it wasn't because I was off surfing. In fact, the school is quite different now. I just drove down the little road towards Campus Point, and the engineering building is now Frank something Hall. Harold Frank Hall, correct, yeah. I used to, you know, I came here to surf and to study engineering, and I used to sit in the engineering building, in that building, and see waves peel off Campus Point, and, you know, like a little kid in a candy store without any money, because I didn't have time to surf. I was studying too much. At least that's the way it was in the first couple of years. I think that the beautiful thing about coming to UC Santa Barbara, and I'll have to admit, I really was a little bit nervous coming here to talk, because this is the only school that I ever dreamed of speaking at. Okay, I've spoken at tons of other schools. I'm a little bit rusty now because I haven't done any speaking since my boys were born. But I've done a lot of talks, mostly to entrepreneur classes at MBA, in MBA programs and stuff, and triathlon clubs. I was told that there'd be a few triathletes here. Are there any triathletes here? One? Okay, cool. Are you also a technology management student?
No.
No? All right, cool.
We can't go engineer them.
What's that?
We can't go engineer them.
All right, well, cool, because I'm not going to be talking a whole lot about triathlon other than... you know, going through and discussing some of the products we make and stuff like that. So I came to UC Santa Barbara longing for water much warmer than there was in Monterey. And I lived on the 8th floor of San Nicolas dorm. I felt like I was in paradise. I'm sure many of you do too in certain ways. After the first year and a half or so, I kind of got settled into the idea that, hey, things aren't going to always be perfect. I'm not going to be getting those straight A's. But then I also have to, you know, wash my laundry and cook meals and things like that. After I left San Nicolas dorm. So the remainder of my time here, I lived at 6511 number 4. Does that place even still exist? Del Playa. I'm sure it probably does. It probably still has the same sofas that were in it when half those sofas spent, you know, half the year outside and half the year inside. You know, it was class, living, friends. Back then, you know, we were dealing with the opening of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, you know, Jackson Brown and Neil Young and all these guys would be playing at its down below Stork Tower to, you know, call in the troops, and, you know, all the freaks would show up. I'm not talking about UCSB students. I'm talking about all the other freaks, you know, that come to listen to the music and try to stop a nuclear power plant from opening. But it for me is probably one of the greatest memories of my life, Although I can assure you that as many people, as many times as you might hear people say to you, enjoy the time at Santa Barbara, it's going to be the best 4 years of your life. It gets better. It really does. It's different, but it gets better if you make the decision to make it better, okay? Your social life becomes different. It's not so much about how many people you're with, but how good the people are that you're with. You start to form relationships that last more than just the time here at school. I still have friends from here, but I've formed friends after, and you will too, that will astound you the depth of the friendship that you will find. So, surfing, Campus Point. When I tell the story anywhere else, nobody can picture what it's like, but if you've ever seen the waves break there, it's awesome. I mean, you know, Rincon is great. Jeffreys Bay is great. Namotu is great. Campus Point can be that good when you see the waves peeling that way. One day I was out surfing. It wasn't even really that big. I fell off my board and I hit my head. I wasn't in really that deep of water. When I came up, I tried to reach for my board and I realized that I can only reach it with one arm. I had pinched a nerve in my spine, the C5, which controlled the motor function of my right upper body. All I could do was this, but I couldn't do this, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do any of that. I couldn't talk out of the right side of my face. Doctors had not diagnosed me. Fortunately, I didn't sever any nerves. The paralysis might not be permanent. That was the best that they could give me. Over the course of a couple of months, the right side of my face drooped. This was the day before my 20th birthday. My bicep became as thin as my wrist. I wore long-sleeve shirts on ridiculously hot days so that nobody would see this arm. And it was a huge change for me, given the fact that I'd always been so active. Fortunately, I was still able to grab the handlebars of my bike and ride my bike everywhere. I had a Bianchi Campione d'Italia. It was a 10-speed bike. I rigged up at the bike shop here at UCSB to be able to pull both brake levers or both brake calipers with one lever. Took some fine tuning so that I wouldn't flip off the front of the bars, so that I wouldn't slide out in water. It was the most devastating thing that had happened to me, and I felt sorry for myself for just a little while. And it was a lot of nights of crying. It was a lot of nights of wondering if I was going to be that person that everybody would look at walking down the street with a skinny arm and, you know, a droopy face and talking out of the side of my mouth like this. And if I drink a little bit too much tequila, it still kind of shows that accident had happened. But it's usually because I've got a big smile and it's just not even anymore. As part of my process, my healing process, I just decided, okay, I needed to do something different. So I would strap this little skinny arm around my waist and just go out and run. I'd leave campus. I'd run out as far as I could. Hollister Avenue used to have the very, very far end of Hollister Avenue, there was these avocado groves and these trails that would go up into the hills and everything. I'd run south onto the beach. I'd run and run and run and cry and run and cry and cry and cry and run and run and run. As part of the physical therapy, the doctors had suggested that I go to the pool. I know that there's a few different pools now, but it was the only pool that existed on campus, the 50-meter pool, where at the time UC Santa Barbara was the NC2A national champions in water polo 2 years in a row. And all the guys who swam lived on the sixth floor of St. Nicholas Dorm. And I would see these big, massive guys who look like they should have been playing football doing laps, doing their swim workouts. And during their swim workouts, you know, they'd have these little kickboards and they'd kick across the pool. And they would do one-arm drills. And so I just, you know, I asked one of them, hey, man, can you show me this one-arm drill thing, you know? And he showed it to me. And I learned to swim laps with one arm. The other arm was kind of just dragging there, all right? The idea, I think, was just to just keep some range of motion. So what they wanted me to do was just have this kind of dynamic sort of buoyancy where if you pull your hand through the water, it'll kind of float and try to keep some range of motion, some blood flow, things like that. But the atrophy was still there. But I became a really good one-arm swimmer. Not like the swimmers, but better than most people. So one day, I saw this sign for a race. I've already lost my pages here. Let's see, Time in Paradise. Okay. One day I'll figure it out later. One day I saw this sign, and the sign spoke about a race. It was called the triathlon, and it was a mile and a half swim, a 56-mile bike ride, and a 13.1-mile run, a half marathon. Santa Barbara Triathlon. 1981. It was the first year they ever had it. My accident was in March. The race was in October. This was sometime around May, just before I left here to go back up to Monterey for the summer. And I decided this was going to be my purpose throughout the summer, to train for this race, to swim and to bike and to run, not knowing what the heck I was doing, okay? But to train for this race and compete in it. I did some weird training things, you know. From Monterey, one night at midnight, I woke up at midnight, rode my bike with the generator lights back then were about this big, and you'd flip this little switch and it would rub against the tire, and it would, you know, the faster you rode, the more, the brighter the light and stuff. I rode my bike to San Francisco. I got there a little bit before 7 in the morning. I ran San Francisco Marathon, and I rode my bike back to around Mountain View, got on a train, rode back to Salinas, and then rode my bike home. I never did that again, but that was the type of stuff that I figured that I had to do to get ready for this race. I did the race in October. By that point, I was actually starting to get some motor function back in my arm, and I finished. I finished 15th. I was hooked. I remembered going home and writing in my journal at the time. I guess that's a guy's name for a diary, right? A journal. Writing in my journal at the time, this sport can take me someplace. I want to take this sport, and I want to do the following things. I want to be healthy. I want to travel the world. And I want to make a living from triathlon. Let's see if I can find where I'm supposed to be now here, because I don't want to miss anything. Would have been smart if I numbered them, but you know what? That's not me. I just don't number things. All right, here we go. The New Life Triathlon. So, my second race was a race in Malibu. I took first place. I started realizing that there was this popularity. It wasn't big yet. The people who did triathlons were still kind of freaks of nature. They were like the marathoners of the 70s. But it was getting very popular, and it was a kind of a little subculture that was fun to be in, because people who found out, first of all, what a triathlon was and that you did it all without stopping, thought you were some, stud, and they'd ask you a million questions, and they were always really intrigued by it and stuff like that. And of course, everybody knows about the Ironman in Hawaii, and that still remains the biggest race, in the world. It's the world championships of the long distance. But there's so many other aspects of the sport now. There's Olympic distance races that occur in the Olympics, and championships for all different types of distances and stuff, which is really great. I left Santa Barbara, let's see, I graduated in 1983, mechanical engineering, super stoked. Oh, but before I did, my last year here, what I was doing was training. I wasn't surfing anymore, but I was doing my sport, going to class, trying to be as healthy as I could so that I could do as well as I can in the races. But I was doing something else. And I don't even know if it still happens here, but I was going to all these recruitment sessions. Companies would come from all over. Man, it was 1982. It was still the Cold War. Northrop, Ford Aerospace, Lockheed, Boeing, you know, companies that were just hiring engineers left and right. Man, what a great time to be an engineer. And it was a reason, actually, part of the reason why I studied it, because I was actually going to go into architecture, and someone said, you'll never get a job doing that. Go into engineering. There's so many more opportunities. You can even design milk cartons, you know. I mean, everything was in the direction of engineering. I went through all these recruitments, all these interviews. All my friends got jobs. I didn't. Not really sure why. I don't know. Maybe they just probably didn't find my interviewing skills, my talking skills to be very good. By now, you probably realize that I'm not a professional speaker, right? I mean, you can kind of tell that my speaking skills aren't that great. Part of it has to do with the fact that I think in Spanish. I dream in Spanish. If you guys are in my dreams, you're talking to me in Spanish, okay? You are. And I'm answering you in English because I know that you don't understand Spanish. But, so I was done at UC Santa Barbara, would have loved to have stayed, but it was time to go. And the place for me to go, since I didn't have a job, was San Diego, because at the time that was the mecca of the sport of triathlon. Now, I still needed to work, all right? So what I did was, when I got down there, I went around to General Dynamics and Teledyne Ryan and most of the companies aren't even around anymore, so it doesn't really matter. But a bunch of defense contractors and everything, and I just said, listen, here's my degree, UC Santa Barbara, mechanical engineering, emphasis in aerodynamics. But I really have an affinity for fluid mechanics as well. Won't you hire me? How about an internship? I'll work for free. And that's how I got my first job in engineering. I worked for free, okay? The way I made my money was lifeguarding. I worked for the city of San Diego. I was working a lot. I hardly had time to train, but somehow I figured that, you know, how does the song go? I'll sleep when I'm dead. So I managed to make ends meet, but I managed also to kind of get myself to a position within the company where they saw some value in me. And that was by doing two things. Number one, I had an HP 29C. That's a Hewlett-Packard 29 calculator with continuous memory. And this was, you know, before the time of supercomputers and everything. And I was able to program that baby to run all sorts of algorithms and do all sorts of calculations for all sorts of things that all these brown shoes, the engineers at these places back then were retired military officers. Who wore brown wingtips, khakis, white shirts, red, white, and blue ties, navy blue blazers, and would cringe if they saw any piercings. And at the time, I had a few, so I would pull them out when before I would go to work and comb my hair back instead of the flat top that I had at the time. And these guys knew what needed to be made to cause destruction, all right? And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what the, you know, Department of Defense does. And you know, there's a reason why it happens and everything. But I was doing calculations at this company to determine how many people could get killed by a certain sort of bomb, okay? We're doing cool things too. I was on the design team for the fuselage of the Apache helicopter. It's still running now, an amazing machine. It's the very first composite machine to fly anywhere. Super cool stuff, because not only did we design the fuselage, but we had to design things to cut it. Water saws, because you couldn't use metal through these things. They were bulletproof. Super cool stuff. This is the type of stuff that I looked at and just went, man, imagine if you could build a bike out of this. And not more than 8 years later, there were bikes made out of composite materials. I was on the design team of the engine bay doors for the F-18. I was on the design team for the Patriot missile, which got its claim during the first Iran war in Iran. Cool things, but in my mind, call it the hippie in me, I just didn't feel good about designing things that were measured by the number of people who were killed. So I didn't leave just yet, but the other thing that I did do at this school was I developed what might have been considered, or what would be considered now, a corporate wellness program, okay? You guys watch Mad Men? Yeah? Great show, isn't it? It's so great. You know, these guys had those tables with that liquor in their offices, all right? They smoked continuously, all right? Health was not the first thing on their minds. but smoke bothered me immensely. At least cigarette smoke did. And so what I did, I mean, you know, like I like incense and things like that, you know. So, but I started a little newsletter, and I started an incentive program at Teledyne Ryan Aeronautical. By the way, Ryan Aeronautical was the company that built the Spirit of St. Louis, the plane that Charles Lindbergh flew, and that was their claim to fame. Until they developed the Apache helicopter and the cruise and different types of cruise missiles and different types of targets and things like that. But I convinced management by creating a critical mass of people who joined me in offering incentives to the people who smoked not to smoke in the offices. All right, we created a place for smokers to go to smoke if they needed to, but we created incentives for them, such as, I guess maybe when you're young, it's easy to go someplace to a restaurant and say, hey, you know, I work at this company and we've got a lot of smokers and we're trying to get them to quit. So could you give me like a 2-for-1 coupon so that I could give to them if they don't smoke for the entire day? And I accumulated gift certificates and coupons and free running shoes and stuff like that from all sorts of different companies. Nike gave me 1 year over 150 pairs of shoes to give away to people and stuff. We started a walking program at lunch, a running program, a marathon training program. Didn't quite get into the triathlon training thing yet because I still hardly knew what I was doing, okay? But corporate wellness was not a very well-known thing here in the United States. When I decided then, shortly after leaving Teledyne Ryan, to go to MBA school, we studied Japanese management systems and everything. And the Japanese had been doing this for years, all right? Exercises, you know, at certain parts of the day, and beautiful gardens to walk through to relieve stress and stuff like that. And little did I know, because I hadn't taken any management classes yet, that I had started something like this at this company. But I left. All right, I left. I was out of there. I wanted to grow my hair and put my piercings back in and chill at the beach. So I continued to lifeguard for quite some time. All right, I better keep moving here. The mix, the second university. So I went to MBA school at San Diego State. It was really an excuse to keep racing. MBA school was super easy compared to engineering. I learned that I was a pretty good BSer because that's what a lot of it was. We did do a lot of Harvard graduate management school sort of case study things, you know, where you know a company is having a problem and you get together with your team and you put together an analysis of, you know, how to make things better, you know. Let me tell you something. Nobody ever told me that when you try to collect on receivables, you guys have taken some business classes, right? And you call people and say, hey, you know, first of all, oh yeah, collect on receivables. That's a great way to create cash flow. There's a reason why it's so hard, all right? People lie to your face. They lie to you on the phone. They tell you there's a check in the mail, and there really isn't, all right? They'll tell you for, you know, they'll give you a million excuses as, you know, create all sorts of stories. And that's the realities of the things that you will come to learn through the classes that you're taking here. And hopefully it's not quite as idealistic as it was back then, because it was an eye-opener when I started my company. One more little part of triathlon here before I move into DeSoto Sport. MBA school was 2 years. It took me 4.5. And the reason why is that I was racing pretty well. I was making money. I had sponsors. I got performance incentives. I got photo incentives. I had small stipends from a number of my sponsors. I had to make appearances at trade shows and things like that. But it was all working pretty well. But and I was a good triathlete. I was at times pretty great, but I was not among the greatest. In other words, at the biggest races, it was rare that I ever won. I had won now and then, but it was rare. What I learned, though, what I started calling cherry picking, that is, if there's a world championship going on and all the top guys are in Hawaii and there's a race in the French Riviera in Nice, France, and they're all there, weigh it out, okay? Start doing statistics. Start figuring what your odds are. Figure out a way to get there, all right? And I did that mostly in South America because I speak Spanish, okay? Decided that a good way to kind of supplement my income, because the triathlon season typically started in May and went until October, was to get on a plane and fly down and race in the summer in South America. Emilio's version of endless summer. I convinced a race director down there in Pucón, Chile, super cool little mountain town just north of the Patagonias. An amazing volcano called the Villarrica volcano. It's still live. There are European ski teams that go and train there in the summer because there's snow there in the winter, even during their summer. Okay, I convinced him to buy my ticket down there, and I said, I'm going to do well. You know, I talk to him in Spanish, and you know, I'll give interviews and everything else. Well, when I flew down, hey, I was there. My bike, everything was there. We showed up at press conferences and everything. And all these American and European pro triathletes, guys better than me, you know, they're being asked all these questions, and they couldn't speak a word of Spanish. So I translated for them, all right? And tried to be as humorous as I could, you know, at least create some jokes and stuff, just to kind of get the media maybe to kind of pay attention to me. I'm the one that's doing the translating. I'm not a translator. I'm an athlete too. All right. And anyway, as all these pros went to their hotels to go to sleep, I went off to a campground, pitched a tent, and spent my days and nights there. Raced pretty well, but still not quite enough to afford a hotel. Well, actually, I probably could, but you know, I preferred instead to stay in the tent. My first year, I spent 6 weeks down there. Part of the time in tents, part of the time in pensiones, part of the time I actually worked in a couple people's farms. I helped shave alpacas. I harvested some fruit and vegetables and things like that. Because again, even though you've got money coming in, at least for me, it wasn't, yeah, let's go high roll, man. Let's, you know, you're still looking for the cheap beers and the affordable food and ways to kind of make sure that you can, you know, prolong your visit. The other thing that I was doing while I was there was that I wasn't paying rent anywhere here in the U.S., you see? So I was saving my pennies. Throughout the years, I did pretty well in the sport. I saved up quite a bit of money, enough to buy a little 500-square-foot condominium in San Diego. And it was a good place to come home to after being, you know, in South America in the winter. I spent my 30th birthday sitting on a beach called Guarujá on the south coast of Brazil. I'm sorry, not Guarujá, Boiçucanga, between Guarujá and Rio. Super cool place. I'd become friends with a guy whose father was the president of Bovespa, the Brazilian stock exchange. He had this huge yacht. I got to stay on the yacht the entire time if I scraped all the barnacles off the bottom while the boat was in port. Everything was great. You know, went to Carnival. We flew to Angel Falls. Spent a week and a half in the Grand Sabana. Hiked Machu Picchu. Went down to Tierra del Fuego at the south end of the continent. Got to really experience all the amazing things. All the while, you know, my competition was training. I was off in all these really great places. But I got to have a lot more fun than they did. But when I turned 30, I was sitting on this beach, and I just said to myself, I've overcome paralysis. I became an Eagle Scout. Paralysis was harder. I graduated from UC Santa Barbara, mechanical engineering. The paralysis was harder. I turned the accident into a new love of triathlon. I've got to do something different. I need to exit the sport when I choose to instead of when I have to. So I started to write up a business plan, and the business plan was to start a clothing company. And there wasn't really anything in particular that made me decide to do it other than I thought it was would be kind of a cool thing, all right? It wasn't like I had some kind of crazy idea of, like, there's a void in the market, and so I'm going to become the person who fills that void. It was just, it was 1990. You know, there were companies like Rusty and Quicksilver and Gotcha and Spot Sport and, all these surf companies and volleyball companies and stuff. And there were even triathlon clothing companies that were starting to form. And these people who had these triathlon clothing companies were basically making swimming, cycling, and running apparel, which is great, right? That's what triathlons are. You swim, you bike, you run, okay? There's an important factor, if you're not familiar with the sport, that is missing between those equations. And we call them T1 and T2, transition 1 and transition 2. And those transitions are where you go from swim to bike, and transition 2, where you go from bike to run. Those transitions are being timed too. So if you're going to change, if you're going to run into a tent or drop trowel or wrap a towel around you and take your swimsuit off and put on bike shorts and put on a bike jersey, and then after you get off the bike, put on run shorts to be a little bit more comfortable. Or, you know, if you're going to go do the whole thing in a banana hammock, you know, or if you're a girl in a bikini or whatever, that's all considered part of the time. And that's how ugly the sport was, you guys. People were racing. Men, hairy men, were racing in little Speedos, all right? It was before the jammers and things like that you see the Michael Phelps of the world swimming in and stuff like that. And, of course, it wasn't so bad seeing a girl, but I don't think the girls liked seeing the guys in those little things. So it came to me, and it was pretty straightforward. Okay, it was so in the face of every other triathlon apparel company, but they didn't see it. I created products that you I created products. I don't know how to get the screen to go big. Let's see if I do this, if it will become bigger, and we'll just kind of leave it. See if this ends up working. Yeah, it's big enough, huh? So I created products that you swim and bike and run in, all without changing. All right? This guy's wearing a suit that we call the lift foil. It's made out of fabric that, again, a term that I came up with, dynamic buoyancy, where when you are swimming in it, even just at a pace of about 2.5 miles an hour, the fabric is designed and knitted in such a way that you actually feel yourself being lifted up a little bit out of the water, okay? Suits like this that are, I'm not saying everybody ought to, walk around in these things, but you got to admit, it's a hell of a lot better than a Speedo, right? I started the company. I grew the business by making pieces that people can wear for the entire race without changing, men and women. Okay, well, here's some other stuff that'll be fun to talk about in a little bit. And I really wish this stuff was in order, but I think you kind of get the general idea. We even made stuff for water skiers, and there's me going down another hill. See, this isn't even supposed to be in this folder. See this bikini? It's got a drawstring in it. So I don't know how many of you guys or girls have ever jumped into big surf and had part of your swimsuit fall off. Guys, sorry, we ruined it for you. This one won't fall off, girls. It's got a nice tight drawstring. It's got clasps on the top and on the back. And it's still really cute. I mean, maximum tanning exposure if that's what you want. But my point being that what we created were pieces that were highly technical in the nature of not only the way they look, but the way they perform and the fabrics and everything. So DeSoto Sport. It was founded in 1990, okay? I wrote this business plan. I presented it to a bunch of guys. The guys who invested in it were triathletes. They were guys who looked at me and said, I think this guy can probably do whatever he is he's talking about, as long as he doesn't, get too hung up in racing. And I was like, no, don't worry. I'm done racing. I'll continue to race, but I'm not going to train 40 hours. I'll train 14 hours, okay? The company grew over time, and rather than getting into a lot of details, because this is, I still want to make that four-hour mark. Rather than getting into a lot of details, I'll let you guys ask the questions that you want to ask in details and stuff about the company. But throughout the course of the early 90s, we started creating products. My first production run, was a couple hundred pairs of these tri-shorts. Okay, that's what we call them. It's a short that you wear. This is the women's version, and there's a men's version. It's kind of like a bike short. There's a little pad in it, but instead of the pad being leather, it was soft and fleecy so that you can swim in it, and it wouldn't absorb a whole lot of water, and you can run in it, and it wouldn't feel like you're wearing a big diaper, and it was still comfortable enough on the bike, to ride, 112 miles and stuff. Things were going great. Things were really going great. We started getting into retailers. We started selling to distributors in different countries. The company was growing. I was seeing myself and this business, this machine, starting to form, and money was flowing in, and we were, creating our image and spending money advertising in dozens of different magazines. We were putting ads in skiing magazines because the snowboarding was getting big. We were making snowboarding apparel. Back then, we were doing a line of women's stuff called body wear. I guess it's, women's active wear sort of stuff. And, we were selling to Nordstrom, and we were selling to all these major department stores, and we were doing 18 trade shows a year and spending all this money. And the bottom line was negative, all right? So we were looking good. Everybody knew who we were, but we were losing money. And the guys who had invested in this company were people who wanted to make sure that this thing was going to work. And it didn't take too many years. We were profitable the first few years and stuff like that, and we started expanding and everything. But I didn't have an outlook of, okay, we got to do this in a certain number of years, otherwise it's going to go under. It just started to happen, all right? I had sales reps, rep groups, distributors. I had employees running around this building that we were renting, fancy machines everywhere, the most high-tech fax machines. We were one of the first 1,000 companies to have a website that sold product. I mean, we were trying to stay on top of technology in so many different ways and everything, and just spending money like there was no tomorrow. And fortunately, During this whole process, and probably a good part of the reason why we were losing money, is that I had one partner. His name was Dan. He's still my best friend. I had one partner who said to me, hey, this is going well. We ought to get the rest of the guys out of this as soon as we can. And I was like, okay, well, yeah, sure. Well, how do you propose? Let's offer them 6 times their original investment. It was only 4 years into this thing, all right? They were looking at they could see the financials. Bottom line, negative, okay? We are losing money, all right? Dan had a little bit more money to play with than these guys did. So they all, with that offer, because basically it was, we'll buy you out, or we have a cash call, all right? We need to raise more money, all right? And so it ended up being now that we had quite a bit of treasury stock because the company bought the money. And Dan said to me, this will be your bonus when the company starts becoming profitable, all right? You and I will be 50-50 partners, okay? Some of the partners, one of the partners didn't even invest money. He had a warehouse space in Santa Ana, a little bit north of San Diego, about 90 miles. And for the first 6 months, I lived up there inside that warehouse. I slept on a shelf on rolls of fabric, you know, of fleece, and had a microwave and a shower and toilet, pretty much all the things you need, you know. So there were some humble times. But this was a big eye-opener for me. All right. And I said to Dan, this is going to be my plan. I started this because of my love for triathlon. All right. I'm going to drop everything, every segment of the products and categories that we have and go back to triathlon. I fired so many people. It was crazy. So many sales reps. We eliminated everything, the snowboarding, the body wear, the thermal layers, anything that didn't have to do with swimming, cycling, and running, and went back to our roots. We became a smaller company. It only took a year and a half to become profitable. And a good part of it had to do with the fact that the sport was growing. It was soon to become an Olympic sport. And there was a really, really positive momentum. Economy was doing great. Keep in mind, this was 97, 98, 99. What did Warren Buffett say? It was an era of irrational exuberance. Okay. I had friends working for Oracle who were living by me at the beach, who were, you know, salesmen for Oracle, closing deals from a cell phone on the beach with a laptop in their hands, and now these guys are, it's a different world now, okay? I mean, it really is. As good as things are in many segments of the economy, of the tech boom and everything, it's definitely people are realizing that they have to work again. Anyway, DeSoto, we got ourselves back up, and rather than trying to create more products for different markets, what we decided to do was to create more products for the very market that we had. And so I started by coming and speaking to one of the coaches of one of the swim coaches I spoke to was a coach at UC Santa Barbara. He actually coaches water polo, Wolf Wego. I don't even know if he's still here. Does anybody play water polo? Anybody know Wolf?
Yeah, he's still here.
He's still here? All right. Great man. I spoke to a number of... Sorry about the pictures. I spoke to a number of swim coaches, and I said, listen, our sport is booming, and there's a reason why. Wetsuits have become legal. You can actually wear a wetsuit now to do a triathlon. And what did it permit it to happen? What did it permit to happen? Well, it allowed now for triathlons to be held in the Puget Sound, you know, up by Seattle, English Bay of Vancouver, Milford Sound in New Zealand, places where water temps, you know, are 45, 50, 55 degrees, where people in their right mind wouldn't normally go in and swim, okay? Including San Francisco, that's a huge market there now because everybody can swim in a wetsuit. Well, I asked the question to a lot of these coaches, if you were to be able to take a human body and make them swim faster by shifting where it is that you put buoyancy, okay? An object floats if it weighs less than the water it displaces. Now we're taking and we're moving it. Where would you put it? How would you make these people swim? Show me with your swimmers what happens and how you make them swim. There was this consensus of, well, what we would do is float their hips and legs. And it makes sense if you think about it. The legs have the largest bones, some of the largest muscles in the entire body, okay, as well as the hips. Anything below it are smaller bones. Anything above it is mostly internal organs, okay, organs, lungs that bring in air, and a bunch of little bones, okay? So I created a wetsuit that, and mind you, I didn't invent the triathlon wetsuit. There were wetsuits out there. But just like with the clothing thing, I looked at what was there and said, instead of saying, well, that's the way it is, one-piece wetsuits, and, you know, you put lots of rubber on the body to keep the body warm and maybe thinner rubber on the legs and arms so that you can move around easier and everything, I said, why does it have to be that way? Is it really that important to have flexible rubber, to have thin rubber on the legs? No, it's probably better if we put thicker rubber. And I created this wetsuit that had nice, thick legs and hips. And when you swim in it, it's the opposite of a lifeguard-approved device. Instead of it turning you face up, legs down, it would turn you face down, legs up. I mean, you're literally, you know, it wouldn't be a safe thing to do anything other than swim. And so the T1 wetsuit brand was born. And right now I should be flicking to the logo that would show the T1 wetsuit. But anyway, here's one. It's a two-piece suit. So quick little benefit on a retail standpoint. Say you own a store and you're selling triathlon wetsuits. We have seven sizes of tops, seven sizes of bottoms, okay? With those seven sizes, we can create combinations to fit more bodies, both men and women's, than the other wetsuit brands would be able to do with the 13 sizes of men's and 10 sizes of women's suits. Okay, because you'd buy the top and the bottom separately. So on the standpoint of a retailer, they were carrying less inventory, all right? 14 pieces as opposed to 17 that you weren't even sure were going to work, all right? On the standpoint of someone, of the customer who's buying it, it's kind of like buying, I guess an analogy from the olden days would be separate stereo components, all right? If you buy one of these all-in-one things and you're, again... You guys know what a broken record is? All right, cool. I always wondered, you know, if I'm sounding like a broken record, if that meant anything to this generation. But yeah, vinyl, I guess for some of you, you understand how cool and the wonderful analog sounds that there are from it. Deep, deep, amazing grooves. Really, grooves. They were grooves. So we were able to come up with an idea, not just a second, but this is one of many ideas that we had developed over the years. I'm going to just jump to one last part of DeSoto Sport that we had started doing, and that is this sort of graphics on a product. Obviously, it became famous, you know, or more well-known as we saw, you know, Lance Armstrong win all these Tour de France's and all the jerseys and the logos and everything on it and everything. This sort of graphics is called sublimation. It's super cool. You basically apply to a substrate, in this case it's a polyester fabric, an ink with heat. All right, so it's kind of like a heat press, okay? Or an iron-on, all right? But when you apply the heat to this fabric, the ink turns into a gas, and it adheres to the substrate, okay, without affecting the technical integrity of the fabric. So here's, you know, one of our pieces. And as you'll see, probably a better example is this one here. This, you know, beautiful colors and everything. They don't fade. They don't run. Nothing ever wears out. The fabric on the inside the still white. Okay, it's still breathable. Okay, it's not like putting like a plastic iron on or something like that. This is essentially the same concept that Starbucks uses to put their logos on coffee mugs. Okay, the substrate in that case is ceramic. Okay, we, with the growth of the sport of triathlon now into universities, corporate programs and things like that, we got into the custom apparel business as well. And this is just an additional way that we have continued to sort of have this metaphoric metamorphosis, continuing to change as we see opportunities to grow our business. Am I running a little over on time? Okay. So let me just skip down then to the very end of it here. Just last year, I bought the rest of my business from my business partner, so I now own it all. And I'm kind of running the show. And you guys have seen my family. You've seen my passion for what I do. Am I rich? Do you guys want to know how successful I am? I'm not going to tell you that. I can tell you this. I fly first class. I stay in ridiculously expensive hotels with bathtubs in them, okay? Yet, this is my ride, all right? 1987 VW Westfalia with a hemp canopy, 3mm custom bumpers, original interior. Yes, your dreams can come true as well. By the way, there's my fancy Italian motorcycle. That's a 1979 Vespa P200. I'm into restoring things. This was my machine before, and you guys saw it after. What I want to do right now, and I'm not sure if there's even time with questions and answers or if the recording needs to end or whatever, is I want you guys to consider me you, because I am you, okay? I'm 53, but I am you. I know exactly what you guys are doing, what you're thinking, what you're wondering. Life goes by really fast, and what I'm hoping is, even if at the end of the recording you wish to do so, ask me the questions that you would ask yourself if you could speak to yourself in 33, 34 years, okay? It could be about the business. It could be about life in general. Success to me might be a little bit differently than you, you know, having seen that we choose to live a farm-to-table lifestyle and, you know, we're going to get chickens pretty soon, have our own eggs, and, you know, we try to have minimize the impact on our environment. Restoring a machine like this is a lot better for the environment than a Prius. Have you ever wondered where all those battery cells are going to go in 15 years? I used to say, have you ever wondered where those battery cells are going to go in 25 years? Now it's 10 years later. Okay, they're not recyclable. If you could think of something to do with those battery cells, you're going to be rich. All right. If you can figure out a way to keep that stuff from going into the landfill, there is becoming a critical mass of people like me who can't afford to live in big homes and drive different sorts of cars that are trying to take what we've got and scale down, okay, and just enjoy life. If what you want is a big mansion, great. Go chase after it, okay? You deserve it. Make sure that that is a result of your success and not what defines you. Same with a nice car. By the way, my wife drives a 2014 Land Rover with 475 horsepower engine. The black on black on black version, it's sick. All right, it really is. But it's also got airbags that will blow out of every corner to protect my boys. So we bought it because it was a tank that's got 475 horsepower. So. So please, as I open it up here, first of all, I want to thank you very much. Hopefully, what I've given you so far is informative enough. My email address is emilio@desotosport.com. Our Facebook is DeSoto Sport Triathlon Company. Emilio DeSoto is my Facebook name. Like me, I'll like you back. Like our company, you will all find that one of the things that I am blessed to be able to do And you will see, as I'll answer every single one of your emails or your Facebook messages if you ever have any questions moving forward, okay? But if you have any questions right now, I'll stick around and answer them, all right? God bless you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.